You're listening to the Back Home Network, presented by Homefield Apparel.
And welcome, Hoosier fans, to this week's edition of Assembly Call Radio, where each week we discuss the most important topics in the world of Indiana basketball. This is our 325th edition of Assembly Call Radio, and it's our 1,008th episode overall of the Assembly Call, recorded on the evening of February 1st, 2024. I'm your host, the coach, Brian Tonsoni. And let's begin this edition of the Assembly Call, how we begin every edition of the Assembly Call, and that is with our Hoosier Proud banner moment. This week's banner moment happened on Tuesday evening. Let's all go back to a time in our youth, a time in our driveway or local basketball hoop or local playground. We're dribbling the basketball. We're counting down the clock. We're saying in our heads, maybe even saying out loud, the Hoosiers are down one with 5 seconds left. The countdown closes in on zero. We take the shot. Quote, it went in. The Hoosiers have won the game on a buzzer beater. End of quote. I'm talking about a dream. A dream we all had many times in our own basketball worlds on those driveways and playgrounds. Well, Anthony Leo had similar dreams, and last Tuesday night he got to live out that driveway dream. Anthony scored a career high with 13 points, three three-pointers, a nice drive, some free throws. He added 7 rebounds, some awesome passing, and some great defense. Anthony Leo had his dream game. The Leo game came at a good time. A time where all Hoosiers, players, coaches, staff, fans, we're all struggling with losing and poor performances and how to react to it all. Anthony Leo's dream game provided us all with some relief. See, Anthony Leo is a Hoosier. An Indiana Hoosier, basketball player, a former Indiana High School Mr. Basketball, and yes, a former Hoosier youngster in the driveway shooting hoops. Thanks, Anthony, for the banner moment of the week and a memory we will all remember. Hey, Anthony, keep on living out those dreams. Go Hoosiers. Okay, now let me introduce my co-hosts for the week. Jared and Ryan are both out this week. Ryan is already drinking beer in Bloomington, having flown in this afternoon and had dinner. I doubt that he's even listening or thinking about the show. Jared's flight is leaving early tomorrow morning, so he's wishing his kids good night, kissing them, and packing up and getting ready to fly out at 7 in the morning. But here we are. We have the Josh Schertz of Girls Youth Sports Coaching in Cincinnati, the president emeritus of the Robert Johnson Fan Club and one of the world's most renowned bracketologists.
The best of youth sports coaching, you know that we got him. When it comes to analytic trends, you know he can spot them. For first-class bracketology, if you want the top, you gotta go bottom. If you want the top, you gotta go bottom. If you want the top, you gotta go bottom.
Andy, what is your bottoms line on the last week in Indiana basketball?
Well, I didn't get the chance to be on Tuesday with you guys, and so you know that really is the big story of the week for me. Not only IU getting a much needed victory, playing well, playing with some adversity. Being able to come through it. But as you said, Anthony Leal, just a great story. Awesome to see him step up in such key situations and really be such a difference maker in the game. Not to overshadow completely what Khalil Ware did on, you know, 1 to 1.5 legs, it felt like. But, you know, he had an impressive performance as well. So you hope that this is something that the team can really rally around and build off of and move forward. And build some momentum here down the rest of the season. There's still plenty of games left. So you hope that that's something that they really, you know, like you said, gave some relief initially, but hopefully give some confidence too as we move forward. another winnable game on Saturday at home, and use those things as a springboard to get you into the last, you know, eight or so games of league play, and see what can happen from there. And so we'll talk more about that game as we go on, but some interesting things, some changes that we saw, and most importantly, just glad they could come away with the victory, a good team win, and awesome to see them rally together and overcome what seemed like for a minute there another Iowa miracle shot that was going to sink IU, and to not let that get them down and come back and pull out the victory in the end was certainly great.
Also here with us, we have a former basketball coach turned business leader who you know as the founder and editor of the IU Film Room. He's also the proud papa of two sharpshooting future Hoosier guards in the classes of 2038 and 2040.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's Coach Adronia. No matter where you're looking, never gonna find a man with a plan to use all that he knows to educate the fan as he breaks down the yeses and O's.
Tony breaks it down. Would he draw it up? Tony breaks it down. Would he draw it up? Tony breaks it down. Would he draw it up?
Ladies and gentlemen, it's Coach Adronia. What's on your mind after a week of Indiana basketball that saw a nice victory over the Iowa Hawkeyes?
I know I'm biased, but man, I love that song.
It's catchy.
It's pretty catchy.
Woody draws it up.
It's good stuff. Thanks to Bob Thompson for all of our music. But yeah, with that said, you know, super fired up to be here tonight. Super fired up about, you know, the win Tuesday night, and you know, really coming out of that victory more unscathed than I probably thought right after the game. You know, all indications I thought were, you know, X is probably done. You know, Renew's ankle didn't look great. Ware was hobbling around the court, and then, you know, things start coming out from different outlets that, you know, X-rays were negative on everybody. And things are, you know, trending in a good direction. Doesn't mean all of them are going to play this Saturday, but, you know, all things considered, a gutsy win from Indiana against Iowa. You come out of it, you're a little bit more healthy than maybe you thought you were, or you're going to be healthier at least, which is great news. So, you know, as Andy said, we'll chat about that game later and some of the things that I've seen, you know, Indiana change that I thought kind of helped allow them to be in that game against Iowa. But I'm really fired up about Saturday, you know, going to get to hang out with everybody with our meetup at Upstairs Pub. And, you know, it's always one of my favorite weekends of the year when we get to convene with all the folks, you know, that in our community and that watch assembly call. So I'm fired up for, you know, this weekend and hopefully also see an Indiana W in the process.
Very good. Segment one today, we're going to just maybe go over a little bit of that Penn State game that's coming up Saturday and talk about our meetup. Segment two, we're going to talk about Iowa, as Tony said. And then we have some really great questions coming up in segment three. All of that will be here this week on Assembly Call Radio. And now let's talk about our presenting sponsor. This edition of Assembly Call Radio, just like all shows on the Back Home Network, is presented by our friends at Home Field Apparel, where they have the largest collection of vintage IU apparel that you'll find anywhere. And it's not just IU, though their founder and CEO Connor did recently tease here on our show that a big IU refresh is coming soon, but Home Field has something for fans and grads of pretty much every school, with unique vintage logos for all of those schools. No matter what you buy, you know it'll be comfortable, the colors will last through many washings, and plus, you're supporting an Indiana-based company that came up through Kelly. What could be better than that? I put Home Field up on the smart board today for our students as we were studying entrepreneurship, always hoping that maybe we get two or three purchases for Connor and Home Field, and we spread the Home Field love in the classroom. So, you know, all the future earners need to buy Home Field. I got a little Gonzaga on. They need a little help because they're not in the tournament right now and struggling. So I thought I'd throw this sweatshirt on tonight, one of my many, many, many purchases. Milwaukee, one of our former bracketologists, Andy, is a baseball Division I baseball player at University of Milwaukee, so I'm going to have to buy a University of Milwaukee sweatshirt. Go buy some stuff and go to homefieldapparel.com and use our promo code HOME23 for 15% off your entire first order. That's promo code HOME23 for 15% off. Once again, the website is homefieldapparel.com. Wear one for the team. All right, here's some Hoosier headlines for us. As Tony mentioned, the meetup is starting tomorrow. We'll be in town for a team dinner. We will be out out in the town somewhere. Come find us, and drinks are on Bob Motes. He said he's going to have a tab, so make sure that you come and get that tab as high as we possibly can. Joking there, to be honest. But we'll be at the Upstairs Pub after the game. Galen and Scott Caulfield will be watching the game there and providing halftime and immediate post-game entertainment. We're sponsored by Hard Truth Distillery. T-shirts will be provided for over 100 folks, or about the first 100. There'll be a raffle supporting the Hoosier Ticket Project also on Saturday at the post-game. And we will be doing a show. It will not be live on YouTube, so make sure, as our usual post-game shows come on 3 or 4 minutes after the end of the game, it will not be on live Saturday. We are taping it. Once we all leave Assembly Hall and get back to Upstairs Pub, we will be taping it and putting it out for later consumption. Also, Indiana in the metrics. It's one of the things that struggle. Indiana still has a chance to have a good, positive winning season, but the metrics are a big part of where you land in the postseason. Bart Torvik has Indiana 77th. Ken Pom has Indiana 88th. The net, which is the main sorting tool for the NCAA committee, 94th. Evan Maya, 84th. So there's some issues there with the offense and defensive efficiency all year. We have seen some good things in the last two games that are moving those in the right direction. Does Indiana have enough time? And Andy, I got a question for you when I'm done reading all these questions. Well, let's just go to that right now. We'll get to the IU Penn State later. What are there targets that IU fans should be looking for in these metrics that are passable for a tournament team? I know you and I are probably going to be Debbie Downers to those IU fans after a big win from Iowa. We got to be honest about Indiana's chances. If there was a good run, where does Indiana kind of have to get in these metrics, in your opinion? And is it possible?
I think I guess one would be, you know, Torvik and Evan Maya aren't on the team sheet, so they don't really factor in to anything. I definitely don't have history on those. I think the highest net team to get in was like 77, I want to say.
Yep. Rutgers.
Which was Rutgers. And I think that was a year they had like a really weird resume. They had some huge, huge wins, but also had multiple bad losses. And so their net ended out kind of high, but at least they could really hang their hat on. There's a few really good wins that were there. So, you know, that's ultimately the biggest challenge for IU. They're not going to be able to pick up enough big wins at this point to be able to have, you know, the highest net anybody's ever had. So I think you got to work your way up pretty far. I mean, I don't know. There's not really a true cutoff. You know, I think what you want to look at when you're looking at these other metrics is looking at the resume metrics. So that is the strength of record and KPI. Those are the ones that really measure what you've done. The predictives are BPI and KenPom, and those matter less for selection. So you really need to see IU get better in those other metrics, and I don't have in front of me where they are right now.
They are 70 in KPI and 57 in strength of record.
I think somebody had told me that nobody had ever gotten in. I think one of the other guys in the Fielding the 68 show had said nobody had ever gotten in with those over, like averaging out to over 60 or something like that. All right, maybe it wasn't them. I think it was Graham Dorn. I want to try to give credit to whoever it was that said it. I think it was him or Kerry Miller, but nevertheless, IU's got work to do. You know, the predictives are hurt a lot by not winning the non-conference games by a wide margin. Nothing you can do about that now. You just need to go win games and try to get enough there. And as we've talked about before, just not a lot of great, great wins to get from a Big Ten perspective. This game on Saturday is the only remaining Q3 game, at least as of the last I looked at it. So you definitely want to take care of business in that one. But they just need to win a lot of games, quite honestly. I'm not saying they got to win out, but they really got to stack wins at this point. I know there's a couple of bracketology-related questions later. So I don't think there's real targets there. There's not a true, if you don't get to this, you won't get in. There's some history around some of those, but every resume is a little bit different. So they got work to do for sure.
As far as the metrics, and we'll talk about quad wins and the quality on the schedule left in the great bracketology questions in segment three. They got to get in to have any chance low 70s, high 60s, and then that's got to probably with some big wins, including Purdue, Wisconsin, that will help get the metrics up to get those quality wins to have a chance. And then I think the best case scenario from our vantage point is they get a couple big wins and that metric gets up somewhere in the 60s, maybe, if it can get there. And then you make a run in the Big Ten, kind of like year one under Woodson would be the dream scenario now. And I'm not smart enough to put a percentage on what that likely is to be. I'm not counting on that, and that's not trying to be pessimistic. It's just these numbers are somewhat, you know, solid, and it takes a lot of wins and a lot of good play in a row to change these metrics. Tony, we're going to come to you first on this. IU versus Penn State Saturday at noon. We don't know what Malik and X are going to do. We received good news overall about the longevity of their injuries, but it does seem possible that Indiana may play without both of these. I think X is almost certainly out. Malik has a better chance to play, but we're not counting on him being ready to go Saturday. Penn State has an injury. Kane Clary, sophomore, who's taken a big jump this season. He was day-to-day a few years ago, so he might be able to play on Saturday.
A few days ago, not a few years ago. I mean, he could have been a few years ago, too.
A few days ago. Totally misread the – I wonder what you're laughing at. Like, did I mispronounce his name?
Well, you did that too. You did that too, but that wasn't why we were laughing. So, I think it's Kanye Clary.
Kanye Clary, day-to-day, a few days ago. So there's a better chance he plays.
He did not play Saturday at Rutgers, for what that's worth.
He missed a couple games at junior high school, so we'll see.
He was hurt as a middle schooler. All right, it's tough. I'm really going to buy some beer from Bob Motes now with you guys ripping me on that. But well-deserved. So Kanye Clary, watch to see if he'll play Saturday. Penn State's 1-8 on the road, just beat Rutgers, though. And their strengths are turnover margin, defending the three-point line, and then they have a veteran team. Weaknesses, shooting, defending the twos, fouling and putting people on the foul line, and rebounding. Tony, the keys that you think, coming off a nice win against Iowa, handling some adversity with some players and some new minutes and new roles that we don't know about yet until game time, what do you think is the key Saturday for the Hoosiers to get their second win in a row?
Yeah, I mean, in all honesty, Penn State, their three-point rate is fairly high, so don't let them see one get in early and build some confidence, because their three-point shooting is some of the worst in the country. I think they're like 30% in three-point shooting. Indiana is the best in three-point defense in Big Ten play currently. So, yeah, I mean, in all honesty, Indiana on paper is better. I think they're better, you know, well-equipped. You got a game in Assembly Hall. I think Jared made a great point the other night that, like, was kind of worried about this Saturday being kind of a dud in Assembly Hall prior to the Iowa game. Like, if you're coming off of four losses, you're playing a bad Penn State team, it's a noon tip, like, the energy in the building might not be great. But now I feel like not only did the Iowa game kind of rejuvenate, re-energize the team, but quite possibly the fan base as well. And so I think you'll see a much better environment on Saturday based on the way they played on Tuesday, because the way they won Tuesday, you know, it was one of those games where, and I know I'm getting into Iowa now, but it's leading into what I think about Penn State is, like, it was one of those games where if Indiana did happen to lose, you're not happy about it, but they fought like hell. They, you know, executed offensively, defensively, the game plan. Iowa kid, you know, made a tough shot, and, you know, you lose the game. Like, you live with it. You don't ever want to lose, but it was one of the ones you could have lived with if they did lose it the way in which it happened. Instead, they win, so you feel pretty dang good about it. Like I said, they played hard. Guys stepped up. You know, Coach Woodson has constantly preached the next man up mentality. Guys stepped up. And so that's really what I'm looking for against Penn State, is more of just a carryover of things we saw against Iowa. You know, great defensive execution. The offense was a little bit more open. And, you know, I think you'll see that, especially if one of Malik or Ware is out And so those are things that intrigued me the other night. And so really, I'm just looking for more of a carryover from the Iowa game and put Penn State away.
I think, Coach, you make a really good point. That, and maybe I overblow this a little bit, but that was an Indiana win. What I mean, everyone contributed. You know, the 10 minutes in the second half when they made the comeback, you know, was a little disappointing, but that happens. Runs happen in a game of basketball. But I'm huge on handling that adversity within the game. And you had an injury at the 17-minute mark with your stud, and then you had an injury late. You had a late shot. You had a comeback from an 11-point halftime lead. And Indiana teams of the past that we've fallen in love with have been resolved enough to overcome that, especially in Assembly Hall. And so not only was it a win to end a three-game losing streak, but it was a win that we all kind of can attach to, or at least this old guy can attach to, that used to happen all the time, that next man up mentality. That's Indiana basketball. And then especially with, you know, Leal and even like Gabe Cupps, who has struggled to score the basketball, hits a huge, huge three. So it was just everyone. Walker contributed. Ware was outstanding for that one stretch of offensive rebounds and putbacks. It was just a quality win. I do agree that that got a little juice going, and hopefully Saturday at noon that place is hopping because those young men deserve that. Andy, coming to you, we don't know who's available and everything, but let's assume Malik and X are out. How does IU start the game, and what kind of things do you think will be the keys for Penn State? I know that kind of overlaps with some of the changes we've seen in the last 2 weeks that we'll talk about in segment two. But specifically for Penn State, what do you think the lineups are going to be and some of the key performers need to be with those two possibly being out?
Yeah, I think you know, a couple quick things on Penn State. You know, one, the turnovers is a big deal. They force them at a high rate, but they also commit them at a high rate. So can IU, who doesn't normally force a ton, can they get some going the other way? But obviously there have been games this year where things have snowballed in IU. They've had turnovers in bunches, and how do you do some of those things? You're going to see a variety of looks from Penn State. Mike Rhodes comes from VCU, and the whole havoc, they're not running that exactly, but they're have elements of it. And so that's going to be a big one. It's just staying composed, taking care of the ball, because the other numbers for Penn State aren't particularly good defensively, which suggests you beat the press, you take care of the ball, you're going to get a good shot. So if IU can handle that, be in the right spots, I think that becomes really important in the game. And then from a player standpoint, you know, Clary is their leading scorer at a little bit over 18 points a game, shoots the three well. So he's a guy, if he's playing, you really got to be aware of. But no matter what, the guy who makes it all go is Ace Baldwin. He followed Rhodes from VCU, was, I think, the A-10 player of the year last year. So a really, really good point guard, good defender, great defender. And so you got to be able to try to kind of control him on either end of the floor and figure out what you're going to do there. When you think lineup-wise, you know, you can kind of pencil in at this point Galloway, Mbako, and Ware, and then it's kind of how you fill in around them. My assumption would be you'd see Walker in the starting lineup and probably Cupps, just because that's at least a set of guys who have started games before. I don't know if that's too much of a leap to kind of go put Leal in there. I think he probably earned that opportunity if you give it to him. But I think as a coach, you're probably trying to figure out, how am I going to start the game? Is he a guy who can really, because of his basketball IQ, watch some of the things from the bench, be able to point things out and see things? That's one of the things with him that really stood out to me. There was I think it was in the first half, a play where he's up yelling at Peyton Sparks to get up on, I think it was Sanford. And just because he'd gotten switched on to him, I think it was probably you're not really thinking probably a whole lot that you're going to have to guard this guy, pointing it out. And like, so Sparks just runs out and, gets out to him before he can get an open shot, before he even got the ball, because he's so attuned to what's going on the bench. So you would not have to make you wouldn't have to twist my arm to say that Leo could be in the starting lineup, and I think it probably is a case where he ends up playing a lot. I think, again, against a team who's pressing, a guy like that serves you well. You want a guy who's smart, going to be in the right spot, going to get other guys in the right spot, and then be able to attack things from there once you break it. So I think he's going to have a big role. If I had to bet, he wouldn't start, just because he hasn't so far. But that would be the way that I would think that it would go. I don't think you're going to see, at least at the onset, a lineup that has Mbako at the four and then Cupps, Leal, Galloway in the backcourt, although you may see that lineup at some point during the game.
We saw it against Iowa, and that's kind of foreshadowing what we're going to talk about in segment two. And guys are going to have to be ready. You know, CJ Gunn has seen limited minutes. He's going to have to play a role. He's probably the seventh or eighth man off the bench, depending on who needs to come out. Peyton Sparks is going to have to rotate in there for Ware and Walker. And then, again, how do you back up that four if Malik is out? Do you go with Mbako down there at the four and play the a smaller lineup? Those are all things that are going to play. But this is a game that Indiana should win and needs to win to continue going despite the injuries. And I know there's always a lot of talk, well, we lost this game, we lost this game because they're injured, but we won two Big Ten games without X at the beginning of the year. We would rather have X play. Obviously, it makes Indiana better, and we think Indiana's better with our full complement of players. That is a no-brainer. But you play. My team is on the floor. You have to go out and protect home court. And if there is any chance at postseason, this is a game that is a must game, regardless of who is healthy and who isn't healthy. We're going to talk about some of the changes that I think we've seen coming up here in segment two. So stick with us here.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Here, we're going to talk Iowa and some changes that have been good for Indiana in the last couple weeks. Stick with us. All right, everybody. Thanks for being here. Glad you're here. It's always a good assembly call radio after wins. Just like the post game show is a first half, I was all excited and wrote the start of the show, and then all of a sudden, Indiana's trailing at the end. I'm like, crap. Now it's going to be how do you do that? And then they end up winning, so it was a good show.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, I mean, it was the kind of game, I think you said this earlier, Coach, the kind of game we've seen IU teams lose plenty of times and plenty of reasons and excuses you could point to if you do lose it. But
specifically like I said, Iowa.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, who the opponent was, yeah, made it even worse in some ways. But,
man.
So hopefully something to build on for sure.
That was a nice play that they hit there to take that lead on that inbounds play with limited shot clock time. I mean, it was just well executed.
I mean,
well
just defended. Takes an absolutely like perfect pass to throw that
yeah.
distance.
Perfect pass,
just
yeah.
Crazy. Just
perfect shot. I mean, and perfect defense was played.
Yeah, because a lot of times kids will run through that and foul, right? Because you got caught up a little bit in the screen and you're closing out and then you bail out a team at the 1.7 seconds left on the shot clock or whatever that was. With three free throws or two free throws if his foot was on the line. So it was well defended and had to be perfect. And that's just, you got to be kidding me, type of play. But the credit does go to the guys for finding a way to fight back. So
it was kind of like a variation of that Brad Stevens play that everybody runs sideline out of bounds now, where he like fades a post guy and then they
yep.
run a guy off that pin down like to the opposite side of the floor. A lot of
we
teams
call
run
that wiper.
Now.
I was going to say, I feel like Carolina ran that against Kentucky and something
yep.
a
yep.
couple years ago in that CBS thing that they and they we got would, a, they got a basket to win it or tie it off of or something like that.
So. Yeah, we would love to. We worked that at Western. We would throw it across the court screen towards the ball and send a guy back and throw it, and then we would. It's a reverse hammer. You know, the hammer's on the baseline when you baseline drift hammer screen. But we called it a wiper because we brought a guy back towards the ball, the three-point shooter. So you get your best shooter coming off that top screen. That's good stuff, though.
It is.
I hate that. I have to say that about Fran, but holy cow, did I see
it? It was an offensive play. I mean, what are you going to do?
That's true. That's true. I saw a Fran-like meltdown last night for Delphi Bracketology. I was in Mackey. Holy cow, Chris Collins.
That was glorious. That was fantastic.
Unbelievable. I'm up in the media. And
Fran is the connective tissue because he's the guy who stared down Courtney Green last year. Apparently, Collins should have tried that and get him to just, you know, turn a blind eye to the blatant hook and whatever else.
Yeah. I see them going down the other end, and all of a sudden I look, and there is this Collins come charging to the back. He was all the way in the 3 second lane. Just yelling at the official, and then he just was lifting his arms to the crowd when he was going out, and it was epic. But
the technical was one thing. The fact that he was like shook hands with a couple guys and dapped up Edie before he hyped up the crowd and left, like the series of events that he did after he got thrown out was just outstanding.
And I'm good as he's cussing the guy out, just fantastic stuff.
It was. And then I didn't know if he'd come in and do the press conference. He was awesome in the press conference. He was calm, cool, collected. He wouldn't answer a specific question about the officials, but he kept saying, have you guys ever – you've done a lot of ball games. Have you ever seen 50-plus free throw advantage? Yeah. Will you look at this box score? I've never seen a box score like this. He was doing everything but calling them out. And I will tell everyone this, too. It's what I am very fortunate now that I'm not coaching high school basketball, that I get to go cover a lot of these games. And I know a lot of these post-game conferences are on YouTube and people can go watch them, but I get to see them live. There was a student reporter from Northwestern, and the room was packed, and he stumbled on his question. And then he panicked and he forgot he had to hand off the mic, and it was an embarrassing moment for him. And Coach Collins, after getting ejected, an overtime loss, a difficult loss, he knows this kid because it's a regular. He said, hey, you're still my dude. I love you. Hang in there. And he went on to ask another question, and the kid got composed and asked a question. And I just thought, you know, we get all mad at people all the time and the losses, but, man, there's a guy who was hot, a losing coach, last thing he wants to do, and he still had the class to – make a young reporter who's trying to, you know, hone his craft. I just thought that was classy. I don't know if that was picked up and anyone saw that when they were watching Big Ten or whatever else, but I thought that was a really cool moment by Coach Collins.
Yeah, that's cool. The anti-Boeheim, I think we can call that. Isn't there a question, Coach, later about some of the foul disparity and stuff like that? There was one, right?
I think there's a question that kind of alludes to that.
Maybe we can talk a little bit more about that game then. There are definitely elements of that to discuss that.
That would probably be worthwhile. Edie is hard to guard, hard to play against, and hard to officiate.
Nobody like him.
Hard.
Yep.
Because we'll talk about that there. Let's go here into segment two. All right, here we go.
All right.
Hi, this is AJ Moyer. What's the only thing better than upsetting Duke in the Sweet 16? Celebrating it with friends afterwards. Join Jared, Andy, Ryan, and Coach for the assembly call after every IU basketball game. Go Hoosiers.
Welcome back to the Assembly Call. I'm the coach, Brian Tonsoni, here with Andy Bottoms and Coach Adranez. We're going to now talk a little bit about the Iowa game. I was on the post-game show, so I'm going to let these two awesome dudes share their thoughts on what happened. But, fellas, I'm just going to sum up this and then toss the stuff to you. It seemed like the week off that Indiana had before the Illinois game really was beneficial. I think the two defensive efforts and what they forced Illinois to do and have a bad night and forced Illinois to stand an awful lot, the defensive effort at Illinois was good in a loss. And I thought holding Iowa to 68 points, and a, you know, not a perfect points per possession defensive effort, but again, Iowa is known for offensive efficiency. I thought those two performances were really good, and we're seeing some other adjustments with subs and things of that nature. So segment two, fellas, is going to be yours. We'll start Coach Adranya. What changes have you seen? What adjustments have you seen that you have liked in these last two ball games since that week bye for Indiana?
Sure, yeah. My biggest one is Indiana on the defensive end and how they're guarding ball screens has been schematically changed. You know, Indiana, at one point this season, their opponents were shooting like 39% from three-point land. Now, some of that is just pure chance and, you know, water finds its level and things, but they were one of the worst in the country at guarding the three-point line, and a lot of that was coming off of ball screen actions because, for one, Indiana was going over the top of screens, so they're having to fight over. So then the help side was really getting dragged in because the ball handler had free rein because they were in drop coverage, which is basically where the big basically continues to retreat until the guard can come back to his man. So Indiana was just getting all out of whack in their help, and you know, the kind of the nail slot rim stuff that we've talked about previously essentially ended in overhelping and guys getting wide open looks. And it was kind of happening again and again and again. And we saw it last year a little bit with the Penn State game, especially like where Penn State just got open look after open look. But Indiana has made a conscious change in how they're guarding ball screens really since, from what I can see, the Purdue game. Like I said, Indiana is now number one in Big Ten games. Indiana is number one in guarding the three-point line. Opponents are shooting, I believe, 26% from three in Big Ten games against the Hoosiers. And that's a stark contrast to where they were in non-conference play. And they're going under screens. And I think what a lot of people don't realize, and to an extent probably Woody didn't necessarily realize about college players, is like spot up is king. And when you're trying to shoot threes off the dribble, there's not a lot of guys in college basketball that are knocking that down at a consistent level off ball screens. Whereas NBA, you know, that's a shot you got to be able to make if you're a guard in the NBA. College basketball, it's not necessarily that. So really, IU used to be kind of sacrificing dribble pull-ups going under screens for spot-up looks, which in college basketball, far and away a better shot. So they now are not helping. At some point, they're even staying glued to shooters, and they're just allowing that 15-foot jump shot as the guard goes underneath and the big goes into drop coverage. If you go back and watch the Iowa game, you'll see it a lot. Tony Perkins will go off a ball screen. Sanford's in the corner, and XJ or Gabe or whoever stays glued to Sanford. And Ware does his drop coverage, and Perkins really goes one-on-one, and he shoots a lot of tough shots, a lot of tough twos, which is exactly the shot you want your team to shoot. So to me, that has been the biggest difference. They also did it against Illinois. And like I said, they even did it against Purdue. They dared Braden Smith to shoot threes. Braden Smith, a very good shooter. He actually shot really poorly in that Purdue game, a lot of that off of that ball screen action. So they're seeing the fruits of their labor in terms of that. And what I really liked was they made an adjust. So they're going under all ball screens pretty much. Sanford was hot. They started going over on him. So it wasn't like it was just like this is our coverage and we're sticking to it. It was like, here's our coverage. And then if this guy's going to go off, like we're going to go over and we'll force him to drive. So very much scout driven stuff. So that to me was like, all right, maybe it's not, you know, maybe there's not as much stubbornness there as we maybe thought in terms of like, this is my defense and this is what we're going to do. And you could talk about it till you're blue in the face, which I am. I'm going very long-winded now at this point talking about this. But, you know, in the NBA, you've got 82 games to figure things out. So, you know, 10 to 12 games of trying different things or trying a scheme isn't really a big chunk in the grand scheme of things. In college basketball, you know, it's less than half of that. So you take 10 to 12 games to learn a scheme and it's not working, you've lost a third of your season. And that's kind of what I think we've seen with Indiana here. And it's an adjustment. It just is for Coach Woodson to kind of have his season shrunk like this. And what's why I think with the subs and stuff, like he gave them more run than he probably should have in certain games, trying to like get them ready to go in situations where he needed them. And now you know, it's kind of crunch time, and he's gone away from, you know, those subbing patterns that we saw. The defensive scheme has changed, and Indiana looks a lot better, to be quite honest.
Coach, I want to hit on a couple points before I go to you, Andy. One, Indiana's been 12-7 every year under Woodson. And last year they took off and had a good regular season. The other year they lost 5 out of 7 and had to have that run in order to get a 12 seed. This year 12-7 again. So it does seem like a pattern of trying stuff out early and then settling in on what is going to work better late. That has been a pattern for three. I think that was a very good point. And I do think the defense of sticking to shooters, I agree with you about Purdue. So it was maybe even before the long break and even maybe a little bit at Wisconsin. But they are making a change with that instead of that penetration stuff at the nail all the time. They're making some good adjustments there. But defensively, they've done a fantastic job with that. Andy, what have you seen that's different in the last couple of games and maybe specifically the Iowa game that you really think is good?
Well, I think, you know, both the things that I'll bring up may be more out of necessity than by design. But although I think, you know, one of them is the substitution patterns. Tony alluded to that a little bit. Injuries have played a role in some of that stuff changing. But I think even prior to that, you were seeing some, you know, less of that as you go on. And so I think that's been a positive thing. You've seen guys, though, like CJ Gunn and Caleb Banks. And I think this may be another thing just in terms of like what you're trying to figure out from a season perspective and how it compares to the NBA. I think Ryan Carrazza brought up a similar point on Inside the Hall today. And yeah, to Tony's point, 10 games in an NBA season is, you know, 12% of the season, 12.5%. Well, 12% of a college season is like 4 games. And what we're seeing is you're going to run these 10 games through. I'm giving everybody a chance to play and then kind of figure it out. And now those guys are getting squeezed a little bit, and we can have conversations about what that might mean for development or how you do some of those things and figure it out. But you are seeing a bit more of you know, a shorter rotation and more mixing and matching, at least of different guys. And then offensively, these last couple of games have forced, either without Ware or without Renew, have forced there to be better floor spacing when you're getting some of these looks out there where you got 4 guards or 3 guards in Mbako and different things like that. And it really is pretty stark how it can open up the floor for different situations. I know Tony talked about that in one of his film rooms about how to get Xavier Johnson going and looking at screenshots of what's happening year over year. And you just can't get enough guys out of the way, out of the lane. Sometimes when you're playing the two bigs, despite the fact that they've shot the three well, that's not really how they've been deployed. I mean, they've made those threes off of different situations, but you're not starting in a, you know, 4-out-1-in setup. You're not starting in a 5-out setup. So you're running all these things and then there's no place to go in there. So again, somewhat by necessity, but I think you've seen better spacing and you've seen IU do a little bit more of what you see in other modern college basketball teams in terms of being able to drive, kick out, attack a closeout, find another guy, do those things, and then be able to have guys who have their feet set, ready to shoot. That cup shot at the end, yeah, he's wide open, but he's also ready to catch the ball, shooting in a much better position than him going off the dribble where he's not going to fade to one side or the other. Make or miss, that's a good shot, and one that he got from, you know, Galloway being able to get in the lane, kick it out, and do some of those things. I thought Ware did a decent job because he's so much taller than anybody that Iowa had, being able to really see over the top and being able to find guys, you know, from 3-point range. Now that didn't happen as much in the Illinois game, so you teed me up to talk about Iowa. That wasn't really the case there, but I think that floor spacing has been a lot better based on the lineups that he's almost been forced to play.
Andy, and both of Tony in your film room, the play that stood out to me was, I think, the third or fourth possession of Iowa. They had already run that double pin action baseline for a catch and three for Mbako, where the guard screens on one block, and then he comes off that double floppy or whatever you want to call it. But then the action that I really liked that spoke to what both of you are saying and gives spacing was then they ran a double down screen to the corner for Mbako. So there's three guys on the three-point line to the left side. X had it on the right wing, and X drove the ball. And that was your film room when you said that it was clouded in there or crowded in there, and guards can't get clear shots. And I think XJ got fouled on that. I don't think he made the basket. But he had a clear drive because they were out in the corner and they were having to play the best three-point threat, Mbako. So, Andy, that's the spacing with the different lineups and then the different actions. And that's a positive. The suggestion would be we need to see more of that deep into the game. I think what we see in is a lot of preparation before the game, and the first 5 to 8 minutes are somewhat scripted, and they want to do this action and this action and then this action. And then sometimes I don't see that as much as, you know, and maybe I'm old-fashioned, Coach Adranya, that if something works and you got your best shooter, I'm a run the damn thing five times, keep hitting it until they make an adjustment, right? Especially with the kid like Mbako, when you saw him – when he's gone and hit shots early, it's really been a good thing. And other than the Purdue game when he got in foul trouble, you want to get multiple people involved early, but then you got to come back to it. And other than timeouts and out of bounds, where I think Woodson is just fantastic in those situations, I would love to see him have a little more thumb. I've said this for years on calling some of the stuff that they call in the first 5 minutes of each half on that. Was there anything, guys, Andy, I'll come back to you first for this one, then to Tony, anything that you didn't like as far as an adjustment or you feel is still an issue with Indiana despite the win?
Yeah, one other thing to hit on the positive side, and you know, time will tell whether this is schematic or you lucked into it a little bit. I mean, the offensive rebounding was such a key in that game against Iowa, and that's not something IU had done before. Now, whether they saw something from that perspective of being able to try to crash the glass, keep Iowa from getting out and running, do whatever the case may be, or guys just did a good job of, you know, getting rebounds on their own or whatever. Like I said, I don't know enough to know whether that was tactical exactly, but you know, that's really for a team that struggles to score. You got to try to find a way to get easy baskets. I thought they've done that. I think we've seen some really good things from Mbako in that regard, really attacking rebounds, did that well against Illinois. Thought he had some moments of that as well, where he's got the size to be able to go in. You know, you got to take advantage of the benefit. You know, if he's playing the three, he's going to have a size and strength advantage on a lot of guys based on how other teams play. If you're putting him at a potential disadvantage defensively in there, like, take advantage of what he can do on the glass and some of those things. So I think that's a positive. Remains to be seen whether that's something that's sustainable. I think the defensive stuff that Tony talked about, obviously that's a conscious choice. They've done that. They've executed it well. You're going to continue to see it. I don't know whether the offensive rebounding falls in that category, but it is something Penn State has had some issues with at times. So something that could prove critical as well on Saturday again.
If I'm talking about something, and it's not really an adjustment for coach or anything, but Indiana still struggles finding and locating shooters in transition, and McKenzie has gotten so much better in many areas. But watching the game the other night, Woodson was not happy with him losing Sanford three times, right, in transition, and the kid made us pay all three times.
One time,
that, so
Mbako was on this side, as was the Iowa guy. Mbako runs to the opposite corner as his guy runs down that same lane, and Woodson's like, what are you doing? Like, what made you go way to the opposite corner?
How much of this is Woodson having to do some of this stuff because of the injuries to Ware and Malik going to a little smaller lineup? And do you think it's the success that we've seen it a little bit, the four-guard lineup, I believe, at Illinois for about 2 or 3 minutes, but three guards at Illinois when you bring Leo in with Galloway and X or whoever else is in there, and you saw it a lot more in the Iowa. How much of that was because of Illinois? Their five is like a three almost with Hawkins, and Iowa the same. They don't have as fluid a five, but smaller teams. Do you think it was just forced matchup, or do you think that it is something that they're really looking at, Tony, and saying, you know, this gives us a little bit more spacing, as we've all talked about and you did in your film room? Do you think it'll continue, I guess, is what I'm asking?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of both. And I think sometimes when you're coaching a team, sometimes it's hard to see the forest through the trees. And, like, look, Malik Renu is your best player. Khloé Ware is your NBA guy. McKenzie Mbako is a guy you're trying to get to the NBA. And so when you're the coach, like, you're like, I got to have my three best players on the floor at all time. You know, you just get so wrapped up in that it, like, sometimes it's like hard to get the 30,000 foot view where it's like, oh wow, like, we can run some actions where, you know, my two bigs aren't planted on the blocks or whatever the case may be. So I think now that they've seen it and it can be successful, I can't see that they would now retract that. Maybe I'm wrong. I mean, I Woodson did say in the coach's show after the Illinois game, he would have liked to see how Illinois matched up against the two bigs. So, you know, there's, he still certainly, he likes those two bigs there. I think he likes the size advantage and all of those things. But at the same time, it's really interesting because, you know, it's like you get so wrapped up into Woody and, like, you know, is he just old school and he wants to play two bigs and things like that. But then, like, he ran a very modern action when it was, I think it was the four guards on the floor and where he ran XJ off of a ghost screen for the ball to Galloway. And then he did a double screen with Mbako and Ware, and he exited Xavier Johnson to the opposite side of the floor. And sorry, I know my hand movements and things are really hard to follow right now, but basically what it ended up happening was Trey Galloway came off of a screen, Mbako floated to the three-point line where they have to guard him, Ware went to the rim, and his guy just set the screen, so his guy's got to now hedge on the ball. And Xavier Johnson exited the opposite side, so there's no help, basically, to tag Ware. So he gets a lob to the rim, and if Mbako guy wants to help, then you get a three to the corner. Like, that is a very modern action. It's modern basketball. So it's not like he has this mindset of, like, he's not learning anything or he's only going to play 2000s basketball. Like, he's got these things in his head. So that's, like, kind of the point I want to make is, like, it's not like this is all foreign to him. He knows these things. He has these concepts in his bag. So to me, it's like, all right, let's see a little bit more of it. So that's,
I agree.
That part of it is what's interesting to me.
I agree, and that's my point of having your thumb on the offense. I think college teams need to be run by a coach, or as a lot of teams are doing now, an offensive coordinator to take it away from a coach, because a coach is thinking officials and subs and official, all this stuff. And you watch Colorado State's doing it, Purdue's doing it. I think Illinois is doing it to some extent, where the offensive guy is calling the action. But I do agree. I think there is no doubt in my mind that there are good modern actions. And put your post players in screeners. Both of those guys can shoot threes. So they're not going to be, you know, you're not going to put a big guy at the rim when Ware is out at the three-point line. If he's flare screening or they're double pinning, that's why I said that one action, I will go back to it, that I like to see, and you could do a variety of those things. That double pin down to the corner or down screen to the corner, however, whatever terminology, that just, it took three defenders away from the help, and XJ just drove. And you can do that with two bigs as well. You just don't have to position two bigs constantly at the block and at the dunker spot or diving all the time into the lane and then trying to have someone drive. You had mentioned this before, Andy, about Woodson's hands being forced with the lineup, sir. Are there any questions going forward that you have of, you know, I was happy and I will be happy when it beaten Iowa. And Woodson has not beaten Iowa before, but we know Iowa is not known for its defense. So the offense automatically is going to look a little better. You beat the press, they go to a zone, and the shooters hit shots when they were open, and all that's good. Any lingering questions going forward when you play Penn State? It's Penn State. We should beat them, but now, then you're going to go on the road again and play some teams that are very similar to Indiana and better. Are we progressing? I don't know. Just – thoughts of there. What questions do you have?
Yeah, I'd be curious to get you guys' thoughts on this, because I think the big lingering question for me becomes, if Xavier Johnson is out for a period of time, which seems likely at this point, Galloway becomes your primary facilitator at that point. How do you help him excel in that role? Like, to me, when I watch him, he doesn't seem to have the same pick and roll sense as Xavier Johnson does or has exhibited. Where Trey seems to be his best, either like straight downhill trying to get a layup for himself, or more like drive and kick stuff as opposed to the other way. Or, you know, he's one that likes to go baseline and pitch it to the corner. So I guess my question would be is, like, how do you alter things schematically to run stuff that allows him to take advantage of the stuff that he does well and maybe hide some of the things that he doesn't do as well in that role? We've talked so much about him being asked to do a lot, wear a lot of different hats this year. Like, you got to try to simplify it a little bit for him on offense, at least to figure out where he's most comfortable and what kinds of things he's most comfortable doing, knowing that you're not going to get away from ball screen stuff, because that is, you know, a part of what you're doing offensively, but how do you help him be more effective at the things he does well?
Coach, I'll give you first run.
You guys may have a different opinion than I do on how he handles the pick and roll too. So I could be totally off base there, but he just doesn't seem as comfortable throwing lobs and some of those things in those situations, at least from my view.
You talking about Cups?
Galloway.
Galloway. Yeah. I mean, it's hard because he's just in a completely different role than what he's been asked to do, you know, for the majority of his career in terms of just high usage, a little bit more offense. So it's just tough. He really gets kind of sped up a little bit when he's asked to kind of take over the ball handling duties. I think, what was it? It was like a 48-second span. He had 3 or 4 turnovers on Tuesday night. And then, you know, there's other times where he's just brilliant. And so he's really a tough one to gauge. You know, his shot isn't falling right now, so then that obviously lowers your confidence, which just lowers your level of play in general. You know, I was really hoping that Kansas game would kind of springboard him into what we thought he would be this year, but yeah, with him, it's tough to rely on him to facilitate the offense just because he's been a little bit of Jekyll and Hyde.
Yeah, and some of the answer would be too is Cups is not great going downhill right now. He's not going to beat people like XJ could do that. So I think part of your answer, Andy, is what's the best way to utilize Cups? You can't expect Cups to come in and be XJ and blow by people on the pick and roll or the straight drive to the rim and create stuff right now. He is more of the facilitator. And if that's the case, you move Trey off the ball and put him in situations, run him off screens where the defense is moving, and then he can attack a closeout and do what he does best, which is get in the lane and score or get in the lane and find an open man that isn't involved in ball screens. If the coaching staff thinks that he's struggling with that role, then you put him in a position where he can attack bad closeouts. But that then needs Cups to handle the ball. And I think when XJ has been out, they've had Cups do run the offense. The other thing, the adjustment that I think would have to be made is you can't run a lot of ball screens with Gabe Cups. Gabe Cups is going to have to pass to someone, Mbako coming off a double screen or a flare screen or those things. I think he's more of that type of guard, at least now in his freshman year, and maybe he'll evolve to that ball screen type of point guard. But he's more of the, hey, we're going to get an offense, I'm going to hit the right pass. And the last thing that I'll say just off the top of my head is if Mbako and Leal, and I know we've all been waiting for Gunn to hit it, but if some of these guys can consistently hit 8, 9, 10 threes, and you're running action for them, now that's going to make Galloway's job better because it takes some of the burden. I just think there's been so much defensively, offensively, leadership put on Trey that it has affected his game at times. Sometimes he's been outstanding, sometimes he hasn't. I think all of that combined, that he needs his teammates to play a little bit better to alleviate some of that usage and some of the stress on scoring and everything. I don't think he's a 20-point scorer. He's a 10 to 12. If he gets – I think the key, Andy, is if he gets 5 assists or more, Indiana's going to be in a ball game. You know, if he's not passing the ball and has to be the scorer, I don't think Indiana's that good, and that depends on a lot of other people. Coach, your thoughts on that? Any more thoughts on Galloway?
No, I mean, I think I agree with a lot of what you said, and just, you know, there's a lot thrust at him, and that's hard to take all that on. You know, just leadership in general is hard, especially when you're kind of coming into that role and then being asked to kind of be the head of the snake on a lot of different areas. And then, you know, losing your starting point guard, that adds a lot of pressure on you as well. So, yeah, I mean, it's a tough spot, tough role for him. To be in, and you know, you hope he can kind of find this groove coming down the stretch here because Indiana, quite frankly, needs him.
Hey, Andy, the last lingering question before we move on to mailbag, I'll throw it to you and Coach chime in if you want to as well. Anthony Leal had his dream game, is in our banner moment, everyone's happy about it, and we now know that he's practicing really well and he's been very patient. We all are rooting for the kid. What are fair expectations for Anthony Leal in maybe minutes and production going forward? You know, he had his great game, but what's fair for us as fans to expect from Anthony Leo, in your opinion, coming off his career high?
I think it's probably different given what the personnel situation is currently, right? But, but I mean, we've seen the way CJ's Gunn's minutes have gone. So it feels like the opening is there for Leo to get 20 minutes. I mean, I don't know where else you go for some of the time there. And I think with him, I think you expect what you've seen, right? Guy who's going to be in the right spots, will have some struggles defensively at times, but I thought did really well in a guy like Perkins, kind of got his chest into him, didn't get driven, and somebody that can, you know, fight somebody if he's inside a little bit, if he has to, and you go small. So, you know, not going to be able to deal very well with quicker guards, but I think for ones that are a little more physical, like a Perkins, I thought he was really, really had some solid defensive plays down the stretch against him. So I think you look at that, and you just need him to be able to make a couple catch and shoot threes. You know, his one drive, the pickup he had coming up and like laid it in was really good, but that's not what you're looking for him to do. It's a great added bonus, but I mean, if he can stick two threes a game, I think you'd be excited about it, right? Like, so I don't think you're going to see him scoring double figures every game, but if you get 6-8 points, I don't think that's unreasonable. If IU plays small, gets opportunities to get him shots, he's shooting it with confidence and, you know, getting into a little bit of a rhythm because he's getting to play enough. So to me, I'd say he's probably going to play 20 minutes or so a game at this point, maybe a little bit less, maybe a little bit more, depending upon how things are going and what other guys are doing, and chip in 6-8 points. So he rebounded well the other night, grab you a few rebounds, talk about guard rebounding and some of those kinds of things. And he's a good passer. Coach has talked about this for a while, that he's one of the better post-entry guys on the team. So to the extent that this is going to be a team that wants to continue to feed the post, he's a good guy to be able to do that, but then maybe relocate and find his way into some open shots.
Interesting. And Coach, I'm going to come to you. Interesting. You have Cups and Leo, guys that are always, I think, in the right position most of the time, and no one's perfect there. They play really hard. They compete. They understand the game. They're in the right position. And coaches love those type of players, and those players can help a team win. The question is volume, minutes, scoring. You got to have the other guys play at a high level. If Cups is going to score 5 points, Leo might get 10, but he might just get 3, but he's in the right spot defensively, and he's the leader on the team. So you have like a couple glue guys and a somewhat glue guy in Galloway on the floor. You need those other two guys to play at a high level. But there's no doubt that Leo, I think, can contribute with what he's shown and his patience and that. And he will have up and downs just like every player does. But the expectations for me, I think, is fair, is that he's going to come in and do the right things. He's going to be in the right spots. Now, whether he scores will be another, you know, situation that I think it has to be right, and the offense has to work to get him shots. But I think we need to be fair not to expect 13 points a game from the young man going forward. But I think we can be confident that he'll do the right things. And I think he makes Indiana better by being on the floor. I didn't think that was going to happen. I know someone brought that up in Twitter that I thought Gunn was going to take those minutes, but it hasn't happened, and Anthony has performed when his number was called. Fair expectations, Coach, for Anthony Leo from us fans.
Yeah, I think you guys hit it on the head. You know, I think with Leo, he kind of reminds me of – like, especially the game he had the other night was like what you grew to expect out of Miller Kopp. Like, Miller Kopp, he'd have games where he shoots better than Anthony Leo. He's more versatile offensively, certainly. But Miller Kopp, you always knew he was going to be in the right spot on defense. He made the defense better, which is, you know, kind of sounds like an oxymoron to talk about Miller Kopp's defense. But he was always in the right spot. He knew the system. He knew where everybody else needed to be. And then offensively, you know, knocks down open shots. He knows where everybody's got to be. He feeds the post well. Like, those are all things that Miller Kopp did. So to me, Leal has been a nice, you know, obviously it's been a short, small sample size, but he's kind of what I grew to expect out of Kopp last year. It's kind of what I've grown to expect Leal on a lesser level, because it's just going to be lower volume, less minutes, all those different things. But, you know, I think you guys hit it on the head of just knock down open shots, be in the right spots, play hard, lead. You know, there was a moment where I think they were reviewing, they might have been reviewing the Xavier Johnson foul, or they might have been reviewing the Iowa foul, and a couple guys were just kind of squabbling at each other in the huddle, and Anthony Leal stepped in and just kind of like put his arms around the guys and just like was kind of laughing, like, what are you guys, like, what are we even arguing about here? And kind of just like everybody had a laugh. They got back together, and then like the team was good. So even from just like a leadership standpoint, it's great. He understands the scout, like all those things, like you said, matter, and is why, you know, Coach Woodson has now grown to trust him over a guy like CJ Gunn, because he knows he's going to go in and do the right things more times than not.
He was smiling all game long, caught him on camera. He and Sanford had a nice little conversation there. Those are good things to see. A lot of good from the Iowa game. And the lingering question is how much carries over. You know, it's okay. We're happy with the one. But now we want to go two. Then you want to go on the road and win one. You're going to have a couple tough games coming up. You want to keep stacking good days. Stack days. Stack days. Don't be satisfied with one as fans or as players. But coming up here on the Assembly Call Radio, it's mailbag time. Got a bunch of great questions, so we'll answer all of those next. Stick with us here on the Assembly Call. All right. Andy, I'm going to combine the first two bracketology questions for you and I, and then I got a coaching one for...
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/match. Just go to Indeed.com/match right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/match. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank? The new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look in a premium gold luxe packaging. It's all about panoramic volume and fully fanned out lashes. With its tapered brush, the new Panorama Mascara catches every single lash, giving you the false lash look without any of the hassle. Say goodbye to clumps and flakes, because this mascara is specially formulated to resist them all day with up to 24-hour wear. And the best part? It performs better than Luxe mascaras at only a fraction of the cost. You can buy Panorama Mascara on Amazon today.
I'll go okay. to Coach with on the fouling late when you have fouls to give. Your thoughts on why people do that, whether that's a good or not.
I have thoughts on that too, yeah. I'm sure.
Yep.
Yeah, you're good. You're good.
Okay, let's go right into it.
This is Tim Priller, and I never miss an episode of the Assembly Call.
Well, I'd love to see Tim Priller in the world of NIL. The dude probably would have made bank. But hi, I'm Coach Brian Tonsoni. We're here now, mailbag time. I'm here with Andy Bottoms and Coach Adranya. We're going to answer some questions. All of them came via our private IU basketball discussion community on Substack, which you can learn more about by going to assemblycall.com. We have a couple bracketology questions. I'm going to ask both of them, and then I'll just turn it over to Andy to answer those, and I'll fill in. David asks, from a metrics and bracketology perspective, what is the path, if any, besides winning the Big Ten tournament for Indiana to make the NCAA tournament? And then the other comes from Rick Watson along those lines. This is water under the bridge question for our resident bracketologist. And I know there's no exact answer, but a two-part question. We're 88 in KenPom, 94 in net. Had we beat Kansas and Illinois, how much difference would that have made? Had we won all of the bye games by expected or better than expected amounts, where would we probably be sitting in the ranking or bracketology? Take it away, Andy.
Yeah, I'll answer the last part first because somebody had asked me this question on Twitter and I went back and looked at the numbers. The question I got asked on Twitter was basically, how in the world is Iowa 30 spots higher than what Indiana is right now in the net, given that their overall record is pretty much the same, their record in quad one and two is pretty much the same. And the answer lies in the answer to the last part of this question was about beating teams and what the margin was in the non-conference. So both Indiana and Iowa won 8 non-conference games. Iowa was the only one that had a win that fell in Q2, which they beat Seton Hall. But each of their 8, they won by at least 13 points, including that Seton Hall game. So a decent team beat by 13. Total margin of victory for them in those games, 212 points. IU, on the other hand, had 6 of the 8 were Q4 games. The other 2 were Q3, won them by a total of 75 points. So that's a difference of 137 points in those games. Like, that makes a huge difference in efficiency. Like, nobody really played great teams. And so, you know, that's a big difference there. So that's kind of the answer to the last part. Not really a great way to estimate where IU would be in the net beating Kansas and winning at Illinois. But any kind of road win, given what, you know, analytic expectations would have been in that game, would have certainly bumped you up quite a bit. Beating a top team like Kansas at home would have helped quite a bit. I mean, still would only be 2 quad one wins in that scenario, but would have to think they'd at least be in the 70s somewhere and probably closer to being in the conversation than what it feels like they are right now. And then, you know, the other question in terms of, like, what's the path? You know, you look right now, there's 4 quad one games remaining at Purdue, Wisconsin at home, Michigan State at home, and at Ohio State, which is the next game for IU after this Saturday. That one may not be in quad one for long, given the way that Ohio State's playing. They're kind of on the border. Then you look at quad two, you've got home games against Northwestern, Nebraska, and then road games at Maryland, Minnesota, Penn State, and then the home game against Penn State. Like, I'm not so sure. Yeah, the challenge right now is I use 0-7 in quad one games. So basically, according to the net, your 7 toughest games, you lost them all handily, really, except for the Kansas game. I know we all can say that the margin of the Illinois game wasn't as great as the 8 points that it wound up, but the reality is that's what shows up on the team sheet. So you got to probably win 2 of those quad one games, I would guess, and maybe lose, you know, so and almost win the rest of them, you know, quite honestly. Like, I don't know how you get out of there without, you're probably not going to make it if you end up 0-8, 0-9, 0-10 in quad one and you win most of the rest of them. Just don't have that. The Rutgers loss looks worse. So to me, you got to win 2 of those. And if you got 6 other games, I would say at least 5 of those, probably all 6. So you'd need to be 8-2 at that point. You could hang your hat on. You don't have a bad loss. You'd only have 1 loss outside of Q1 at that point, and then at least you'd have a couple Q1 wins. But obviously, it feels like a stretch for a team that we were excited to just win 1 game in a row. So do with that what you will. But
the good news is KenPom has us projected to win all those that you were just talking about too.
Oh, right? Absolutely, exactly. Absolutely, yeah.
The struggle comes with if you just get 2 quad one wins and one of them's at Ohio State, and that may fall out anyway. Like, you have 2 games against Wisconsin and Purdue, which are major, major wins right now. You have to win 2 out of those 3. I mean, you have to beat a Purdue and a Wisconsin, I think. And if you,
well,
only
you got, go you got Michigan, you got Michigan State too.
Yeah, but I don't think that carries as much weight. Who knows where they're going to end up? It is a quad one, but I'm saying I think you need some top quad one wins.
Oh, for
as
sure.
Well, it's
for
just
sure.
if you beat Michigan State and you beat Ohio State and you lose to Wisconsin and Purdue, you're 2-9 in quad one, but your 2 wins, your best win is Michigan State in that situation, and then the Ohio State loses and they fall below 75, and now you only have it's got to win all.
You're not
going to
have enough wins
against
the field at that point. Yeah, that's the other part.
That's the struggle. And to go back to question number 2, if you put all of that together in your question, if you beat Kansas and Illinois and you win the early games, I think you're probably on the bubble in the mid late 40s, early 50s, or small, or the low 50s net wise. If all of your things came true there, I think Indiana's probably sitting in a lot of brackets because you have a couple quad one wins. But the other thing about bracketology is right now our last 4 teams in at Delphi Bracketology, 3-3-4-4 quad one wins, and they're the last 4 teams in the tournament, and Indiana's sitting with 0. You know, and there are a couple teams with two and a few teams with one quad one that are being considered, and depending on where you go in Florida and all that kind of stuff. But Indiana at zero compared to the teams, if you move Indiana up, so the question gets asked a lot, and Andy, I think you agree with this. What does Indiana have to do? Well, Indiana has to do that, plus a lot of teams have to either stay where they're at or fall below for Indiana to move up. If Indiana moves up, other teams have to move down, and there's such a wide variance there. So, but let's play good basketball and learn lessons and develop players and move on. I mean, at the minimum going forward. It's still a reason to watch games and cheer and do all those things despite that.
And so, get a Tony, good draft pick.
Yeah, exactly. Here's a question we'll start out with you. I know Andy wants to chime in on this too. Bill Mullis asked this. My question is, what is the strategy of the unintentional intentional fouls in the last minute of the first half of the Iowa game? I understand the basic strategy of fouling when behind to force an opponent to take free throws. Maybe they'll miss, get the ball back, etc. And I understand in that context that if your team is not yet at the one-on-one limit, then you have to commit multiple fouls. But at the end of the first half, when we're in the lead versus Iowa, what do you seem to call players to commit two fouls in the last minute? And even that did not put Iowa in the bonus. Iowa had possession at 36 seconds, meaning at the end a good defensive possession, we'd maybe get the rebound with a chance for more points. IU fouls reset the shot clock, and then that was now turned off with Iowa inbounding the ball. Seems like a stupid strategy to me, just racking up needless fouls. Never know what is going to happen in the second half. Please explain, because certainly I just don't understand. Thanks. We'll send it to you of why a coach would do that and whether you agree or disagree. And the one point for me is the 36 seconds. It's a key part of making that decision.
Yeah, to me, Indiana botched it. In my opinion, there was no reason you should let Iowa get the last shot of the half off. To me, it actually goes back to there was like 48 seconds left in the half. Indiana had the ball, and that's like a perfect 2-for-1 opportunity, which you see all the time in the NBA. You run a quick set, get a good look, you have an opportunity for 2-for-1. There was no like Indiana had no desire to go 2-for-1. They were kind of walking it around. They were setting things up. They happened to turn the ball over with 36 seconds left to Iowa. Otherwise, there was no 2-for-1 in sight. Then Iowa gets the ball, and I think it was like with 18 seconds left was the first one. So they actually had two fouls to give. So they ding the first one with like 18 seconds or 16 seconds, something like that. Shot clock is now turned off, and Iowa holds for the last possession. And then they fouled again with 10 seconds, which to me is entirely too early, because you still give Iowa ample time to run something. If they get to downhill, like to me, you run that. If they get downhill and you think they have a good opportunity to score, like you give one then, or you want to disrupt the flow and there's 4 or 5 seconds and you know they're about to get their action they want, you give one then. But to just kind of do it aimlessly, and I think, I can't remember who picked up the fouls. I think one of them was on Xavier
Cups
Johnson.
Cups was one, I think.
Because
they took him out, you know, after one of them.
For a team that is really shortening their bench, Woody is very much shortened his bench. To me, it just was kind of needless. And then the fact that you gave Iowa the opportunity for the last shot, I just thought they kind of botched what they thought they were trying to do. To me, it does make sense, like I said, if you're disrupting flow towards the end of the clock and guy gets downhill and you're preventing a scoring opportunity, or you want to make them take it out and run like a short clock situation, sideline out of bounds. But the manner in which Indiana did it just didn't make a lot of sense to me, nor Bill, it seems.
Yeah, I was going to say the same thing, Tony. I mean, to me, you do that as it gets late so you can disrupt them from getting into a flow and make them kind of start over from the sideline. But there was another game, and I forget which one it was. They did it a bunch at the end of the half, and it was just like totally senseless, because they would foul without really running any time. They racked up multiple fouls without really taking any time off the clock. I don't remember which game it was, but I was beside myself trying to figure out what was going on. And it was, I think whoever was on the show that I talked about, like, it clearly wasn't really something that they had practiced or kind of understood situationally. It's no different than fouling up three. If you don't work on it, you set yourself up to botch the situation. That's what it seemed like, that they were given fouls for the sake of giving fouls, not necessarily for the sake of being disruptive. I think that the purpose you see most of the time that people do that is to be disruptive and to take them out of a set. But you got to let them get into the set first before you start doing that, or understand the shot clock situation and say, look, this isn't the time that we need to do that just because you look up and you have that. Not to mention you can't get yourself in a position where you have one guy pick up both the fouls that you're given, and then all of a sudden, especially for a guy who likes to auto bench players when they get two fouls, why are we just racking up two fouls on the same guy? And I know that's not what happened the other night, but I think the other game it did, and you had guys just pick up fouls. So I think there is a strategy to it, but I don't think the way that you did it follows along with at least a strategy that I'm familiar with of why you would do it.
I agree. I have used that strategy before, but it's time specific. If it's, and I don't know exact, but I would say I'm fouling if I'm not in the one-on-one and I have availability of players to foul and maybe put in a sub to foul. So I protect the starters, but I'm looking at 10, 12 seconds, right? Or an emergency. Like, all right, we're guarding, we're going to run the shot clock out, but if a guy blows by you, we'd rather take one and have him reset at 18 seconds if they blow by you, but that wasn't the case. In the previous game, they were telling people on the fly what to do, and Mbako fouled before there's like 0.2 seconds off the clock. So there's the thought behind it, and then there's the execution piece. And in both situations, and then Galloway picked up a foul and Walker went for a shot fake. And I think they ended up getting to a 1-1 anyway, or shot free throws in the previous game that you're referring to, Andy. So the execution wasn't there. I thought that was probably good strategy timing wise, but not executed in the first one. And you're absolutely right. You have to practice it. This one with 36 seconds, I think you just play the shot clock out, only emergency foul. And I don't think Indiana emergency fouled. And then the second one with 18 seconds, they're likely to take the last shot. So you want to take that with five. If they start their action at 5, 6, 7, and then make them go into an out-of-bounds situation. Last night's Purdue-Northwestern in the overtime, Purdue fouled. There was a tie game in regulation. Northwestern had the ball. Purdue fouled with 6 seconds left. And then they forced the ball into the backcourt. And Northwestern still got a good shot. But Coach Collins said they didn't want to take a timeout because they didn't want Purdue to set their defense. Well, Purdue had a foul to give. So there's some strategy, too. You foul, now you can communicate to people, you know, hey, we're trapping ball screens, whatever. You can now make a communication because the clock stopped a little bit better. So there's all kinds of that. It's not bad strategy. But the timing, the execution, the decision when to deploy it, I think was not very good. We're going to Jeanette Maridou asked this: why is there such a discrepancy in foul situations given from team to team in the Big Ten? Andy, what are your thoughts? Does this happen across different leagues, or is it just a Big Ten problem?
I mean, I wonder what could have spurred this question. We were talking about it at one point. I mean, my only assumption is this was based on the Purdue Northwestern game. I can't speak to how much of a discrepancy there is across other leagues, because I just don't watch other leagues closely enough to really know that. I think you see that sporadically from game to game. I think some of it is reputation based. We talked about this with Wisconsin a lot. Like, I think officials get in their heads, like, this is a team that doesn't foul a lot, and they may get away with a little bit more, or some of those things. And then I think you have a team like Purdue with Edie. Like, officiating him is no different than what you looked at with, like, Shaq back when he was in college, quite honestly. He's so much bigger than everybody else. Sometimes he can get called for fouls just because he's bigger than everybody else. But they also let guys just beat the absolute hell out of him. You go back and watch some of those games against Shaq. I think you probably could make this argument about the game when IU beat him in the tournament. Like, just beat the absolute hell out of him. In that game, he actually made free throws. But so I think that's hard, because I think they think, well, the defense is at a disadvantage against them, so we're going to give them a little bit of leeway. But then there's other things that they call that are kind of like touch fouls, and you find yourself asking, what is the guy supposed to do? I think the fact that Purdue generates a lot of fouls through him is not an accident, and not really unwarranted, quite honestly. I think the bigger question is more on, can you watch a Big Ten game and how physical it is at times and look and say, this team really only committed this many fouls? Now, if you're a team who's chucking up threes all day long, I get it. Like, that's fine. You're not really doing that. So, you know, Nebraska, as an example, shoots a lot of threes. They're probably not going to generate a bunch of fouls, and I don't know that anybody's going to complain a whole lot about it, because the reality is their offense isn't designed to get the ball inside and to guys, and to guys to get fouled. So I think there's going to be extremes that probably are too extreme, but I think style of play is a big part of it. And I think with Purdue, for as many fouls as you probably call against ED, you probably didn't call 10 more. But it's just a matter of how you try to figure out, and you got to kind of feel out how the officials are going to handle him in any given game. Some of the games are really going to let him get pushed around. But there's challenges with officiating him on the other side too. The 3 second, you know, there was one possession where I was like, you got to, I mean, you just can't let him stand there that long. And I know he thinks the shot's probably going up and he didn't need to get out and whatever. So there's stuff on the other side of it too. Don't get me wrong, but you also, like, he gets called for fouls too, for just being big, which is, you know, probably a gripe that people could have on the other side of the argument. So I'm not probably as passionate about it as some. I do think that was a little bit much on the discrepancy, but I think you could look at things either way and say some things were justifiable and some things weren't.
Yeah, Coach Collins thought they were driving the basketball, or trying to drive the basketball, so they needed more fouls, but they really didn't get into traffic an awful lot. But Edie is a tough guy to officiate. I don't think he gets enough fouls called on him, to be fair, but I also think, I agree with you, he just gets beaten up. You have to be physical with him. And then the way you beat Purdue is by beating up their guards and beating up Edie, and Indiana tried that in the first game and just fouled a lot too. So, you know, you've got to put pressure on their guards not to pass it into the big fella, and then you foul the big fella, and so that's naturally going to be a part of Purdue basketball. And then I actually had a high school student make a pretty good point today. I about stopped and retired. in bracketology, he said, do you really want officials making sure the fouls are even? That's worse than having a discrepancy, because we were talking about the discrepancy. And in some ways, that made me think, you know, okay, you look up and it's like it's 10 to 6. Now I got to call 4 fouls on Indiana to even it up. I don't think you want officials being.
Well, that would never happen. We know.
Right.
But
he made a good point. Like, the argument that people say it's too big a discrepancy, well, what do you want, you know, some rule to even it up? I thought that was something to think about too. What you do want is officials to be in the right position and call a game consistently. I hate the loose calls in the first half and then tighten it up in the second, or if there's some bickering among players, now you get fouls. There was a foul call in the game last night where there's a rebound. The guy bumped someone on the rebound, had no impact on the game, and they call a foul. And then that leads to one-on-one situations later with the accumulation of fouls. So more of it is consistency in calling plays more than the discrepancy for me. Coach?
Yeah, I'm also – this Wisconsin-Nebraska game just came down to the last second. I think it's going to go to overtime here. So I'm sorry, I was had my eyes on that. But, yeah, with the foul discrepancy – you look at the foul rates of both teams and it's like, it's not that, I mean, the discrepancy was large and it was probably a little too large, but you know, you look at Northwestern, they're 312th in the country in drawing fouls. They're 327th in the country in the amount of fouls they commit in terms of foul rate. You look at Purdue, they are 14th in the country in the amount of fouls they draw. They're 8th in the country in the amount of fouls they commit. In a good way, you know, 22%. So, like, both those teams' styles, like, were on display last night. Purdue gets fouled a lot. They don't foul a lot on the defensive end. Northwestern doesn't get fouled a lot, and they commit a lot of fouls. Like, you know, the numbers kind of are what they are when it comes down to that. Like, again, the discrepancy, there were some things. Like, that last call, they called a block, and Lance Jones hooked the guy, then fell out of bounds. Like, that's, like, where things get amplified, and that's, you know, that was the call that, like, really set Chris Collins over the edge. Like, he waited until he knew the game was out of reach before he went and lost his mind. But he was really mad from the previous call of that block that wasn't really a block.
Just a few more questions, and then we'll go get packed up for the meetup here. Kevin Sermersheim, hope I pronounced that correct. In back-to-back seasons, IU's been assigned technical fouls for the way they gave the ball over after a made shot. I believe it was the game at Iowa last season and then the game at Illinois a week ago. I'll admit I don't watch a ton of non-IU games other than during the NCAA tournament, but I don't ever remember seeing any other team ever get penalized for that. Is the rule ambiguous? Were we truly in the wrong on those plays, or is this an example of incompetency of Big Ten officials? Andy?
I don't remember the one last year, so I can't speak to that one. I think the Illinois one, I think part of it is who it was. I think a big part of it is who it was, quite honestly. I mean, the same thing talked about a minute ago, getting reputations for not fouling. If you think these guys, they've either worked games with Xavier Johnson before, or they know to kind of watch them. So big part of it was that. I think the other big part of it was the way Coleman Hawkins reacted, which was probably overreacting to it, but really drew attention to what had happened. And the third part is, like, you know, you probably just don't need to do that. You know, whether he would tell you after the fact he was doing it to show him up or not, like, you very easily could have just let the ball go through, throw it to the official, do whatever. I think that's what you get some of the time, you know, especially because the clock's just going to run out anyway, so it doesn't even matter. I don't know. I just thought those – I thought things other than the actual action itself amplified what was done and kind of how the officials handled it. But I also don't feel like – I don't feel like I see that in a ton of other games, so I can't really speak to whether it's consistent or not. I think anytime you're throwing the ball at another player, no matter what your intentions, probably going to get somebody's attention. So best to leave it be. But I don't remember the one from last year, so I can't put that one in the proper context.
So, Andy, your last comment is the important thing. When you throw the ball, whether it's just giving them after a basket or not, you bring into effect the officials, where the ball lands, all that kind of stuff. By rule, you're supposed to let it drop, and the official's either supposed to get it, or the team that just got scored upon is supposed to grab it and take it out of bounds. I don't know the college rules specifically, but I know in high school you can get a delay of game for those things, and we would actually do that to get the clock stopped if we didn't have timeouts. We would tell our guys to score, bat the ball out of bounds. You are technically not supposed to do that. And then when you grab it and throw it, but the other point is the officials talk before the game. Like, they had two explosive personalities on the floor in Coleman Hawkins and Xavier Johnson. The three-man crew had to talk and should talk about, we want to make sure we get these guys to play and don't get overheated and watch. X has had multiple flagrant fouls. We want to make sure that he doesn't incite anything or do something. You don't want to do that. You don't want to be looking at it too much, because then you create something, and maybe that was the situation with this. But the ball hit Coleman Hawkins in the face. Do I think it was intentional? No. But knowing X, was it a little bit, I scored, and we got back to four, so here it is. He didn't need to do that, is the point. And because we're Indiana fans, we want to defend X, and we want to complain about the officials. But act like you've been there before. Score, go into halftime, you cut it to four, and let it be, in my opinion. So I'm sure it's happened in other games. Without watching, you probably don't see it. But I do think that it is something players just ought to let the ball go through the net and let it go and stay out of trouble there.
Yeah, I'm not so sure it gets called if Hawkins doesn't react the way that he does. Because, as you said, he is also an explosive personality.
Yeah.
Like, if he just catches it, like, if he's just paying attention and catches it.
If he just catches it and whatever, it probably isn't a big deal. But him kind of charging after him is like, well, you just incited this, so now I'm going to punish you for inciting the situation.
They always tell us it's supposed to be the second guy that gets in trouble. And then the first one does this time.
Yeah.
Yeah, to me, I thought. Oh, sorry.
Go ahead.
I thought it was like a split second. Like, I wasn't as upset about it as a lot of people. Like, he was on his second jump, got the ball. He was on his third jump. It went in. He kind of caught it and threw it. Like, it was such a split second thing. Like, when you slow it down in slow motion, and you like think about all of the, like, that, you know, you look at the flick of the wrist or whatever. Like, I think you could really overanalyze it. It was a reputation call. X kind of made his bed. He's got to lay in it.
Yep, I agree. Kerry Lonis says, did anyone see the Florida Atlantic North Texas game? Good defense. It was nonstop, open the court, run some screens, and drive and kick for three. A lot of threes. It was entertaining. Could you see IU ever going to an offense like that, Coach Adranya?
Is that like some foreshadowing there?
Kerry, we feel your pain. Yes, we did watch that, you know, game. I was watching a lot of other ones, too.
Yeah, I was watching the Notre Dame game the other day, and You really liked the way they were running offense. No, but
don't get coach excited. We can't have that.
I did not watch the game. I have watched several Florida Atlantic games, and they do run a fun style of offense, and they've got a dynamite player. You know, if you ever want to watch good basketball locally, Indiana State is so much fun to watch.
Yes.
Their coach is going to be a high major coach next season. You know, there was a fantastic article actually in The Athletic this week about him. If you get an opportunity to read that, it's great. You know, there's a ton of high level basketball coaches at all levels of the game. I guess is my point here, that run fun stuff. My brother-in-law plays Division II basketball, and his team averages 104 points per game. Like, it's the most fun basketball to watch. If you follow me on Twitter, you probably see me tweet about them a lot. But there's a lot of good styles and fun styles out there to watch. And it seems, you know, sometimes it's at the lower levels where teams, you know, coaches have to get more creative with scheme based on, like, talent deficiencies and things like that.
Yeah, there is, and I do think so, and I think hopefully it's Coach Woodson can evolve and run that himself. This isn't, you know, we're in a positive week, so we're going to stay off any of that negativity. Yes, that is fun offense. I think it's good offense. I think it's winning offense. One of our fellow listeners, I don't know if he's listening tonight, but also is an assistant coach up in Illinois, and he sent me this. His team that he helps coach won 91-71, a record 21 total threes for a high school game. Eighth all time in the Illinois record books for threes. So there is a lot of different ways to play the game of basketball. All coaches have philosophy, but there is a lot of good basketball, which runs a lot of stuff like you mentioned, Kerry. So we're with you. My advice is, like, get three or four smart TVs and watch three or four games, and then keep rooting for our Hoosiers. But college basketball is great. A lot of good stuff. And then our last question comes from our fellow Back Home Network podcaster, Kathy Amos. And she asks, besides seeing me and others, what else are you looking forward to at this weekend's meetup? Is there a place that you have really missed? Andy or Tony, let's go with you first.
Yeah, I mean, you hit the nail on the head with what I'm really looking forward to is seeing everybody, you know, in the community. It's always one of the best weekends of the year. I'm super excited about the venue. Upstairs Pub is a really cool place, and they've done a lot of work to it, and they're really embracing us being there and, you know, making T-shirts, and they've been promoting it a lot. So I'm looking forward to the fine folks there, you know, and having a couple of libations with everybody. So, you know. Big weekend, fun weekend, kicks off here shortly.
Andy.
I would echo what Tony said. Excited about the venue. I've heard great things about what they've done there. Haven't been since they have remodeled it and done some things there. So looking forward to that. Always nice to pop into Nick's, which I'm sure we'll visit at some point, or maybe multiple points. So I guess if there was a place, that would be it for me. It was always my dad's favorite place on campus. So that's where he and I would always go on the occasion that we would get down to a game and stuff like that. So I'll say there as a specific place.
It is amazing how many awesome people listen and tune into this show that I've met over the years that I've done that. And the meetup affords the opportunity to see that. Josh Popejoy, and his friends were yelling AJ Moye at Switchyard last year, and we've met at concerts, and we just had a text exchange, AJ Moye text exchange. Dale is in the chat tonight. We met outside of the right field foul pole. It is just a time to reconnect for those of you who can make it, and for us to say thank you in person for making this so enjoyable. For me, the place, I'm going to kill some Pizza X breadsticks at some point at like 2 a.m. I know there are other places, and that's just free advertising. I'm sorry, Jared. But man, I'm going to kill some Pizza X, a few slices of Pizza X and some breadsticks in the hotel room real late after, you know, Bob Motes buys me several beers at several venues. So Really looking forward to seeing you.
That's it. We're done. No more questions.
All right, Ryan. Hope you're starting things out down there. But that's going to do it for this segment of this week's episode of Assembly Call. If you want to see us do the show live, join us at assemblycall.com on Thursday nights for this live broadcast of our Assembly Call radio recording. Thanks to Bob Thompson for the music, producing our music. Thanks to John Ringer of rigdesign.com for designing our logos. And thank you for listening. Until then,
take it from me, Juwan Morgan. Keep your elbows in, eyes on the rim, and go Hoosiers.
Thank you. Thanks for coming out.
Coach Tonsoni is always right about basketball.
That one didn't play.
Catch me if you can, Coach T.
That'll do it. Thanks, right, everyone, for tuning in on this Thursday. Again, we're looking forward to meeting as many of you as possible. We will be out on the town tomorrow, so try to find us after we're done meeting as a group and having dinner as a group. We will be out, and if you're out as well, come say hello. And then Saturday noon, a reminder, the live game show at Upstairs Pub with Galen and Scott and some other fellow Hoosier fans. And then about an hour after the game is when we're starting to plan the show. We have a lot of different segments. It won't be a regular show. And a reminder to the podcast listeners and to the people who join our live show, post-game show, we will not go live immediately after the Penn State game as we usually do the rest of the season. It will be up on YouTube and in the podcast feeds at a later time. We are going to record it, but we don't have that ability to go live at that point. So make sure you remember that if you can't make it. And fellas, thank you. Great show tonight. Always good talking with you guys.
Yeah, I want to give a shout out to the X's and Joe's guys and then Sam Story. So every time I'm on here, I'm in my office that has nothing on my walls. And last week when I was on for the post-game show, they were laughing because it was just bare. And so this week I ended up with this, it's like the dogs playing poker, gifted to me from Bob, Mike, and Sam Story. So appreciate them seeing my bare walls. And actually, if you see, I got some other memorabilia behind me now. So it sparked change for my wall. I'm going to hang some things up. And now that I've lived here 2 years, I figure I should probably decorate.
Yeah.
Classy place up with the dogs playing poker. I mean.
Right.
And now, again, another reason to drink on Bob Moat's tab. Like,
exactly. He's got the disposable income, obviously.
Proven generosity says it all. Yeah.
I mean, absolutely. if he gives you the dogs playing poker, he can give us a few beers. That's definitely on the cards. All right, everyone.
All right.
Get packed up. Go grab a hotel room. Tickets are expensive for the game for some reason. Maybe because we're going to be in town. Who knows? But looking forward to seeing you. Andy, be safe. We'll see you tomorrow night. We'll see you, Coach, as well.
Yep.
Appreciate everyone. Good night.
Awesome. Thanks, everybody. See you guys.
Bye.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.